This is Washington Watch Weekly, your voice in Washington, D.C. on the issues of faith, family, and freedom. On this week's program, we'll talk about a proposed city ordinance that could potentially ban Christians from public service. Also, Ken Klukowski joins us to talk about an amicus brief we filed with the Supreme Court. But first, Representative Marsha Blackburn of Tennessee takes a moment to share with us about pro-life legislation that is gaining traction. This week, sitting in for FRC President Tony Perkins are two of FRC's own, Chris Gasek and Peter Sprigg.
There has been a debate about pro-life legislation that would incrementally reduce the prevalence of abortion, and one of those approaches has been what's called a pain-capable restriction, limiting abortion or banning abortion beyond the time, the age of gestation, when the unborn child right. can feel pain, which is set at 20 weeks. Now, recent polling asked people what they thought of this kind of restriction on the otherwise unlimited abortion license, and found, ironically, that actually women support this type of restriction at a higher rate than men do. Significant majorities support it. And a Quinnipiac poll showed that 60% of women would support such legislation. Only 50% of men would do so. And then if you add in people who said they'd like to see it, who volunteered that they'd like to see it even more restrictive, you have about two-thirds of women in a Quinnipiac poll said they would support this or more restrictive legislation. About 70% said that in a Washington Post ABC poll. So to discuss that, we're very honored to have with us Representative Marsha Blackburn of Tennessee, Republican Congresswoman from Tennessee, who's in, I believe, her fifth term, representing a district in the western part of the state, just east of Memphis. If
I haven't misled you.
Yeah. If we've looked at the congressional guide correctly. Representative Blackburn, welcome to Washington Watch.
It's good to be with you again. Thank you.
Now, I assume you've seen some of this data about the polling on women's attitudes toward this proposed pain-capable abortion restriction. What is your reaction to that?
Well, I have to tell you, it reflects exactly what we found while we were working on the legislation and what we talked about when we went to the floor of the House and pointed up regularly to our colleagues that, look, this is something that women support. As you said, over 60% of all women support this and think that once that baby can feel pain, that you should not be allowed to do abortions. And they were very much in favor of eliminating these third trimester abortions. And this is something that the American people are with us on this. It is in line with where Americans are, and I think that what they would like to see is the Senate to take up our bill and pass it.
Yes, tell us a little bit more. I didn't mention too much about the specifics of the bill, but the House of Representatives has actually acted on a bill, H.R. 1797, the Pain-Capable Unborn Child Protection Act. Can you tell us a little bit more about the specifics of that bill?
Sure. What it would do is to put a ban on abortions after the 20th week. And the reason we went ahead with this and moving this forward is because of what happened in the Gosnell trials. And you had Gosnell's attorney who even said he thought that the ban should be at 16 to 17 weeks, if that was a better indicator. But the decision was made to go with 20 weeks and to disallow abortions after that 20th week. And here is why. So many of those children who come through preterm labor or for different situations are in our NICUs, our neonatal intensive care units, and they survive, they become healthy, vibrant children, and we know that they are capable of living outside of the womb. We also know that to abort a child at 20 weeks or later is a very, very painful process to that unborn child.
Exactly. Well, this kind of fits into the larger political context of these accusations social conservatives or the Republican Party is waging a war on women. You're a woman. You're a woman in a position of influence, a member of Congress. What do you think about these allegations that there's a war on women?
Well, they're always coming up with something that is a war, and trying to turn issues, and they felt like, I think that what happened is they lost the women's vote in 2010, and they were desperate to get it back in 2012, so they created a fictitious war on women, and they're still trying to perpetrate that. But this just shows you how out of step it is. Their accusations are, and their war is, women support life. Women support eliminating these late-term abortions. And they're completely out of step with that. And it's like with so many other issues that relate to our families and jobs. People are opposed to what this administration is doing, but you know, they're trying to politicize everything that they can possibly politicize, and they think people will agree with them. When people get the facts on what we're doing with eliminating these late-term abortions, they agree with us.
Right, and I think it's important to point out that although those of us who are pro-life and would like to see life protected from the moment of conception to the moment of natural death, frustrated by the regime that was imposed by Roe v. Wade back in 1973 by the Supreme Court, we have had success in this kind of incremental pro-life legislation, both at the state level and to some extent at the federal level. Perhaps the precedent at the federal level, the biggest success at the federal level prior to this was the partial birth abortion ban,
which
was and that was upheld by the United States Supreme Court. Do you feel confident that this pain-capable bill, Unborn Protection, Child Protection Act, would also be upheld if it were to be challenged in court?
Yes, I do think it would be upheld. It is the right type step to make. And, you know, when you read the Constitution and you look at what is there, life, it is the guarantee, that very first mention, the right to life. And so we are going to continue to push forward with this. And I am pleased to see current polling that supports our efforts and what we are seeking to do.
Do you foresee that you will be maybe gaining supporters as this becomes clear in the House? When people go home.
Well, you know, taken it through the House, and we would hope that the Senate, once they realize that this is widely supported by women and that is reflected in everybody's polling, that they will take it up. This is an issue of looking at that 20th week marker and saying, let's not allow abortions after that 20th week. And it is just so broadly supported that I think that the Senate would be well served to take it up.
What should our listeners do? What would you like to see people do?
You know, I think it would be great if they contacted their members of the House and Senate and voiced their support for the legislation, and that as they read these polls and see this polling that is out there right now, that they need to forward that to people in their address book and just highlight with them that this bill is going through and that it is widely supported, and that they hope that their friends will join them in supporting it also and contact their elected representatives.
If you'd like to find out more about our efforts to protect unborn life, we invite you to visit TonyPerkins.com. Again, that's TonyPerkins.com. We'll be back with more Washington Watch Weekly right after this.
On October the 11th through the 13th, join fellow Americans who want to get our country back on the right course. Come to Values Voter Summit in Washington, D.C. and stand for faith, family, and freedom. Mike Huckabee, Senator Rand Paul, Rick Santorum, Star Parker, congressional members are already confirmed. Invited speakers include Dr. Ben Carson, Sean Hannity, Alan West, Governor Jan Brewer, Bobby Jindal, and Scott Walker. Senators Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio, Representatives Eric Cantor, Michelle Bachmann, and more. Today's hottest topics will be addressed: religious liberty, protection of life and marriage, government spending, and national security. Register today for just $99 at valuesvotersummit.org. That's valuesvotersummit.org. This October, stand with others who are committed to taking back our country. Go to valuesvotersummit.org.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. Well, up next, FRC's Peter Sprigg and Chris Gasek are joined by Jonathan Sines of Texas to talk about important news out of San Antonio. Here's Peter Sprigg as he gives us a little background.
Jonathan Sines, and I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, he is the president of Texas Values, an organization that advances family values in the state of Texas the way we try to do here in Washington at Family Research Council. Jonathan, are you with us?
I am. It's great to be with you.
Well, we want to talk today with you about an ordinance that has been proposed in San Antonio that's gotten quite a bit of attention in the conservative media because of how dramatic, really how draconian this particular ordinance is. Now, it's presented as a non-discrimination ordinance, but Jonathan, why don't you describe for us what that ordinance involves and why it's drawn so much attention?
Yeah, it's non-discrimination, I guess, unless you're a Bible-believing Christian,
right,
or particularly if you're somebody that actually cares about the free speech and you think you have your right to an opinion. Now, people are rightly concerned about what's going on in the city of San Antonio, a place where people know the Alamo. The Alamo is a Catholic mission. I mean, there's so much religious imagery and religious culture and religious expression throughout the city of San Antonio that it's hard to imagine if you were going to do something like this anywhere that you would do it in the city of San Antonio. And that's why so many people are concerned. And a lot of this is being pushed or being supported by the mayor of San Antonio, Julian Castro. And so a lot of people feel like this is kind of some of the, you know, attacks on religious liberty that have come from Washington trying to be infiltrated and put into Texas. And so the big problem is two reasons why there are problems with this ordinance. Number one, the ordinance really attacks the freedom of religion and free speech when it comes to so-called discrimination acts. And so, and it applies to any prior act. So if you are a person who has ever said by word or deed, or actually is how it's phrased, any time in the past before this ordinance went into place, you demonstrated a bias, as it's worded. And so essentially, if you've ever opposed homosexuality by word or deed, if you've said anything or done anything to show that you're in opposition to the homosexual lifestyle, you won't be able to participate in city government. You can't be appointed to city council, and I don't even know if they'll let you be on the ballot to run for city council. That's one thing. And it's not just people of homosexuality. It's people that define themselves by a new category that we're starting to see people push under the category of gender identity, whatever that means. There's really no workable definition. That really means how people feel one day to the next about their sexuality. In addition to that, if you want to do business with the city, if you're a private corporation or a private company and you want to do business with the city or the city government, you're going to be banned from doing that unless you also go along with this new policy as well and have that in the type of way that you do business. Otherwise, the city's going to prevent you from doing that as well. And the reason people are concerned is because it's very clear that very often in a church on Sunday or any day during the week, you're going to have Bible-believing Christians that are going to be discussing these matters, talking about what the Bible says, and expressing their disagreement or their differing view from the homosexual lifestyle or the bisexual lifestyle or different varying degrees of gender identity expression that are in conflict with what the Bible teaches. And so you've got some fundamental principles here, and this is a violation of free speech and a violation of religious freedom. And there have been a lot of constitutional scholars that have weighed in. I'm an attorney myself. It's not hard to see why this ordinance has a lot of problems.
It's not just that you may not engage in discrimination while serving on this city board. It's that if you have ever engaged in what they consider discrimination, not just in deed, but in word.
But also is it engaged in discrimination or demonstrated a bias, whatever that means, by word or deed against any. I mean, it's breathtaking.
So if you ever in your life said anything negative regarding one of these protected categories, including expressing a traditional moral view regarding sexual conduct or regarding a person's the difference between male and female, you are forever excluded from appointment to city office. I've just never seen anything like that before. Jonathan, are you aware of any precedent for anything like this?
No, I'm not. I mean, and that's why there's so much concern. I mean, the city of San Antonio, culturally and personally and business-wise, thrives on the religious culture that exists. It has such a backdrop in the Catholic faith, specifically a denomination that has been very clear about the teaching of the definition of marriage and about purity issues and about rejecting homosexual marriage. And so, you know, there are so many people that live in that community that are concerned and rightly shocked by this. I think it's very clear this puts in place, if not a direct, a de facto religious test to be a part of government. And so, that is clearly unconstitutional. And it's a principle that people exist, but it's flipped it. You know, usually you'll hear people saying, well, we shouldn't say that someone has to be a Christian in order to have good values to run for city government or any level of government. You can't have a religious test. Let's not use that criteria. They'll tell us that sometimes. Don't be a one-issue voter, right? This does the opposite of that, but still has the same effect of saying, essentially, if you have a religious belief that does not agree with homosexuality, then you're barred from being a part of government or being participating. That's the same type of religious test. And so, you know, people in Texas care very much about their constitutional freedoms, and being able to express yourself freely is at the top of that list, right along with their freedom of religion, particularly in the city of San Antonio. And we can just see it now. I mean, we've got members of the Texas legislature and the Texas House that currently serve as pastors of their church. That's not uncommon for that to happen. And so I can just see now people sneaking into churches, using their phones to take videos. And we actually had someone who ran for State Board of Education recently in one election. And part of the reason that people used against him to oppose his reelection was he said something in a Sunday school class about his views on the Bible. And they used that to really try to shame him and discourage people from voting for him.
We hope that you'll help Family Research Council continue to shed light on bad legislation, like this ordinance in San Antonio, as we fight for faith, family, and freedom here in Washington, D.C. You can find links to help you do just that when you visit tonyperkins.com. We'll be back right after this.
Everybody says we're on the wrong side of history, but we respectfully disagree. History is not yet written, but we want to help write it. We are the Marriage Generation, children of the 1980s, who remain committed to the meaning and enduring value of marriage. Court rulings and elections cannot define truth. Our passion is to revive a marriage culture and shape the way our generation thinks and talks about marriage. We are not indifferent. We are the Marriage Generation. To learn more about us, visit marriagegeneration.org.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. Well, up next, we welcome back Ken Klukowski as he shares one of FRC's efforts to protect public expressions of faith. Here's Peter Sprigg to get us started.
We have one of our own colleagues here at Family Research Council, the director of our Center for Religious Liberty, Ken Klukowski, is going to share with us about an important brief, amicus brief, friend of the court brief that we have filed in the United States Supreme Court on behalf, not on the behalf of Family Research Council, but on the behalf of some members of Congress. So,
right. And it's an important case regarding religious freedom.
Regarding religious freedom and religion in the public square, the freedom to express religious views in the public square. So, Ken, are you with us?
I am. Thanks for having me, Peter.
Okay, thank you. So tell us about the case, Town of Greece versus Galloway. First about the case and then a little bit about the brief that you worked on.
Absolutely. The Supreme Court in 1983, in a case called Marsh v. Chambers, upheld invocations at the beginning of Congress's daily session or any other policymaking body. It's called legislative prayer. And it was kind of a rare carve-out in those days where the court upheld something. This is during a time when the court was mowing down a lot of traditional expressions of faith. And the town of Greece is a small town in western New York that has this tradition, just like most other local governments around the areas of our listeners who are tuned into the broadcast right now. And in fact, their policy is a very generous one. All town residents can sign up to pray, first come, first serve. They've had plenty of Christians, but they've also had people who are Jewish. They had a Wiccan. They even had an atheist sign up to pray. He backed out at the last minute. No one knew what that would look like, but he was welcome. Nonetheless, there were some militant secularists who filed suit, being represented by Barry Lynn's outfit, Americans United for Separation of Church and State. The federal district judge sided with the town, kind of with a, you've got to be kidding me, they let the witch and the atheist pray. What exactly is your problem here? Nonetheless, the Second Circuit Federal Appeals Court reversed, holding in the most sweeping opinion I've ever seen on this issue, holding that courts can look at what they call the totality of the circumstances, meaning look for anything that gave the impression that the town was endorsing Christianity. Even though they noted that these were all volunteers in a heavily Christian town, they said the fact that there were so many Christians volunteering, that violated the Establishment Clause. The fact that some of those Christians mentioned Jesus or other Christian figures or terms was another violation of the Establishment Clause. And the fact that the prayer givers, a lot of them, when they prayed, they would say, we pray, instead of I pray. And they say, oh, no. Well, if you start saying we, you're saying the whole town believes this. So that violates the Establishment Clause as well. So that was the lower court proceeding where they basically set a bar that no prayer practice anywhere in the country could possibly survive. And thankfully, the U.S. Supreme Court has taken this case, hopefully to restore some sanity to this area of religious liberty.
Now, the brief that you worked on, it's significant because basically the signatories of the brief are members of Congress. Why don't you talk a little bit about the large number of you know, people who members of the Congress who signed on to this and what you see as the significance of that?
Sure, and thanks, Chris. I was honored to have the opportunity here to represent members of Congress before the Supreme Court on this issue, and 85 members of the U.S. House of Representatives signed on to this brief, which is an extraordinarily large number. I think that'll send a positive signal to the court that there's a pretty broad base of support among the American people for the court to take a strong stand for religious liberty, to get back to some of our traditional and historical understanding of the First Amendment, as opposed to the very secular, modern, narrow view that's been taken just in the past couple decades at the court. And yes, the issue that we're taking, as I write in the brief, Congress is regularly seeing its actions nullified that touch upon Congress. There's a federal war memorial in the middle of a desert in California that was struck down, and the only way they could save it was transferring the land to a private veterans organization. There's another one that's been struck down in San Diego. That is in the courts right now, and unless something can be done, that's going to have to be dismantled. And those those displays and expressions from coast to coast. The fact that our national motto is "In God We Trust," that's in the courts. Having a national day of prayer, that's in the courts. Even the Chief Justice of the United States was sued for, when he administered President Obama's oath of office, ending the oath, "So help me God." So we are desperately in need for the court to reaffirm the historical understanding of the First Amendment and just get out of these extraordinarily hostile battlefields that we've been in to even peaceful expressions of faith.
Well, Ken, let me just also say that there's also, because this is being, this decision in the Second Circuit, and then there was another one out of the Fourth Circuit, they're based on federal law principles and federal constitutional principles. They actually directly challenge Congress's prayer policies itself, right? So the Congress isn't just an innocent bystander.
I was going to say, the members of the House may have an interest in this because they begin their own sessions with prayer, do they not?
Absolutely. And in fact, our first, when the Supreme Court upheld legislative prayer back in March in 1983, even though that was a case out of the Nebraska legislature, Congress's, the Supreme Court's primary focus was looking at Congress's practice dating clear back to the founding of this country in the 1780s. And they noted that the very same week that the first Congress wrote the First Amendment, including both the Free Speech Clause and the Establishment Clause, in that very same week, they also passed laws to hire paid chaplains who would be ordained clergymen and offer prayers every day. My first brief in this case actually studies what kinds of prayers are offered in Congress in our modern era, not back in the 1700s, but the way they're offered today. And sure enough, Congress's modern prayer practice would be grossly unconstitutional and would be struck down under the standard that the appeals court applied in this case.
Well, thank you. The case again is Town of Greece versus Galloway, and this will be argued before the Supreme Court and decided roughly when?
Argument, we don't know for sure yet, but the argument is likely it will either be November or December, probably November, with the decision I would expect between April and June of next year.
All right, great. Well, thank you very much, Ken, for joining us. We appreciate your insights on this.
Thanks,
Peter,
Ken.
Chris, thanks for having me.
If you'd like to come alongside Ken and FRC, why don't you take a stand and help out FRC in the process by ordering our brand new Take a Stand t-shirts. You can find out more about it at tonyperkins.com. And for more information on anything you heard today, or if you'd like to find out how you can support the ongoing efforts of the Family Research Council, you can reach us by phone at 866-372-1212, or you can partner with us online at tonyperkins.com. Washington Watch Weekly is sponsored by the Family Research Council.